This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. And we're continuing today with our series from the Kivira Coalition Conference 2015. I'd like now to introduce Owen Hablitzell. He's an educator and consultant in agroecosystem design. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's great to have you here. I love the way you think about agricultural systems because you have not only the kind of like practical hands-on, but also a really kind of big picture and historical and philosophical take on things. And so there's a lot to talk about, and I wanted to start with this question of, I mean, the word sustainable has become a buzzword. It's almost a cliche. Nobody even really has defined it exactly. But the word sustainable agriculture has in some ways given way to regenerative agriculture. We talk about resilient systems. What do these words really mean?
Yeah, well, this is something that comes up a lot, obviously, and there's a lot of discourses going on around all three of those words. For me, and the way that I use them, I feel like all three of them have value. Now, some folks are arguing we should replace sustainable with regenerative or with resilient, but I think they do identify at least slightly different things. So the word sustainable, to me, what's really at stake in that word is kind of longevity, permanence. You know, if it's an activity that we're able to continue to do for the indefinite future, for the foreseeable future, then that could be an activity that would be regarded as sustainable. Whereas regenerative specifically refers to activities that can replace themselves in a sense. So like an organic process, such as growing a tree that's able to be coppiced, which is, you know, to harvest some of the branches and they grow back, for example, would be a regenerative practice because that tree continues to regenerate itself and provide a product, whatever that is, in the form of its branches. Maybe it's willows. We can make baskets in a regenerative way by coppicing willows. But to me, that's a little bit different question than sustainability. So there's value to both words. I think some of the other value of the word sustainability is that people at least have some idea of what you mean already, and they don't have to learn an entirely new word.
Right.
And there's
they've
already
heard it.
They've heard it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
And so, most I would venture to say, of the food that Americans eat comes from agriculture that is not either sustainable or regenerative or resilient or anything else.
That's absolutely correct, yeah.
What does that look like, and, you know, how, well, first of all, just briefly, I mean, I think a lot of people already know about giant fields of monocultures, and we've been talking about those things in
sure.
these series, but that's the non-sustainable part of it?
Yes.
The fact that we have monocultures?
And I mean, that's a big piece of it, and non-resilient. So, you know, a resilient system is something that has a lot of diversity to it, that's basically able to absorb sort of shocks and disturbances and unexpected surprises that come up inevitably in all complex systems, while still maintaining the basic functions that we want to have. That's a resilient system, but a very highly efficient system, which is what our kind of current agricultural paradigm has been aiming for decades now, is increasing efficiency. Well, when the context changes around a highly efficient system, that system is done for. It's painted itself into a corner. There's no option space left for it to advance. And so as our context globally is changing and transforming in an extremely massive way, larger than we've ever experienced before, but not just the biophysical climate change, atmospheric climate change, but social climate change and economic climate change. So we kind of have a triple scenario happening there all at once. And you know, it seems that these systems are increasingly not resilient and kind of, you know, failing to provide.
What does that actually look like? What is an example of what a non-resilient system in this period of great change looks like?
Well, as you pointed out, like a monoculture would be a good example. And so the ways that most agriculture is practiced is to create huge areas of bare ground, plant in an annual crop of some kind. Maybe it's corn, maybe it's soybeans, you know, many other forms of annual crops, which are only around for a year. They're harvested, and then the ground is made bare again. So the result of that process is, you know, anywhere between, depending on who you listen to, 10 or 20 billion tons of topsoil that is lost just to provide a half a ton of food, which is about what one person eats in 1 year.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's obviously, you know, is not resilient and can't continue. And is an example of the fact that I argue we don't even have a food system currently. We have a massive topsoil removal machine with a tiny co-product of, you know, not even very good food.
Not even very good food and not even very nutritious food.
Exactly.
So let's back up millions of years to the place and or places in which human beings evolved, in which they were hunting, gathering, eating, and then starting to actually grow food.
Yes, absolutely. So this is, to me, an exciting model and opportunity and source of information for how to proceed into the future, is to kind of look at our ancestral past and things that we can learn and understand by kind of taking a fresh look at that can provide us some guidelines, some really sensible guidelines for moving forward with our food systems, I believe. So part of this would be, you know, the fact that for the last 6 million years of our human lineage, we've evolved and co-evolved in savanna ecosystems.
Now, what's a savanna?
So a savanna ecosystem is kind of the sweet spot, you might say, right between forest and just the sheer grassland. So it'd be grassland that is has scattered trees, but not such a density of trees as to be a forest. And the dynamics of that system tend to be driven by large herbivores and grazing animals and predators that are kind of maintaining a movement and a high-density behavior.
So kind of a place where the buffalo roam and the deer and the antelope play?
Well, very much so. And so, you know, these are mosaics, of course, that have some more pure grassland and occasional areas that are more pure forest, but on the whole, these regions are scattered trees, grasslands, with dynamics driven by grazing.
And so this is where human beings really came to be who we are, and you've made the point that this is a landscape in which people have a deep kind of instinctive sense of being at home.
That's absolutely correct, and this is why I think, you know, as those kinds of landscapes have receded in the face of monocultural agriculture, that this actually is a huge loss in terms of creating a sense of basically ecological homelessness for humans, that with a genome that actually expects a healthy, whole functioning system, which we could build if we, and many are, in deciding to approach agriculture in a way that would support that type of a structure. So this instinct that you talk about, this is something that comes across in study after study. We can look at, really all you have to do in the first place is go to any park in the world, and you're going to find a savanna, typically. Go to any golf course in the
park,
world.
Yeah, park, right.
You're going to find
like
a public
savanna. Park is a
public
bunch of
park.
Maybe grass or open space with trees.
With scattered trees,
exactly
right, and even many cemeteries, you know, are structured this way, and this is because it's speaking to something deep in us. We want to go home, you know, at that period of time, and that is the human home, because you know, starting 6 million years ago, the planet went through a really massive drying and cooling period, which created shrunk the forests in essence. Especially in Africa, and created huge expanses of new and drier and cooler grasslands and savanna landscapes, and this is kind of when our lineage sort of emerged out of those forests and out into these open areas, where we had to contend with the highest amount of mammal biomass of any other biome. That's the savanna supports that. So this, I think, had a lot to do with even creating human intelligence, insofar as we had to cope with a whole new spectrum of players on the stage, as it were, and figure out what was our place in that.
Right, and our place in it is complicated in the sense that we were predators hunting large game. We were also presumably prey of large felines and things like that. And we had to decide whether we were continually moving around or whether we were staying put, and eventually we started growing things.
Yes, so that with the onset then of the Neolithic, so that pulls us then out of the whole, I guess, Pleistocene, which was, you know, the last 2 million, you know, plus years of our lineage, and so the last 10,000 years, the Neolithic, that's really when, you know, we started growing things and being more sedentary in a sustained way from what had previously occurred, and this was the beginnings, of course, of agriculture.
And so when we look at the kind of savannas on which we evolved, which were very widespread, I mean, the United States is covered with, well, that combination of forest, grassland, and savanna, the combination of those two things, pretty much from coast to coast, if we were to be in our natural state, and much of the rest of the world as well, what kind of agricultural system do you envision? In other words, a system with the savanna as kind of its base?
Well, in essence, yes. In essence, this is something that many people are undertaking in one way or another, and is increasingly the case. So many of the whole farm plans and designs that I'm involved with would create these types of spaces, and that's one of our roles as humans, is we create spaces in where we feel we belong, along with the landscapes that we are inhabiting. So what this would look like in terms of agriculture would be far more multifunctional than the current agriculture we have, far more resilient. So there's studies out there now on savanna ecosystems being, you know, some of the best buffered against climate changes, for example. Some studies out of both Europe and Australia recently that show this. And so the other aspect of this is that it's a perennial-based agriculture. This is a key aspect. So perennial being, you don't have to replant these plants every year. You know, grasses, there are perennial grasses that will grow for, you know, many, many years. There are.
But we don't eat grass.
But we don't eat grass, and the dynamics of savannas have always been driven by the grazing animals. In fact, 60% of the whole nutrient food web in grassland systems goes through the grazing component, you know, the grazing function, which is unlike any other ecosystem on Earth, terrestrial ecosystem at least. Most of those, maybe 1 to 5% of the nutrition or the nutrient dynamics goes through grazers, whereas these grasslands, it's 60%, which is a lot more like actually aquatic ecosystems than terrestrial in that comparison.
What's the equivalent of a grazing fish?
Well, there are grazers of all the algae, this primary production in oceans being those algae that then are grazed by increasingly larger, you know, all the way up the whole aquatic food web, in essence. So, but they're not necessarily like sea cows, although there are those as well, but but not necessarily like massive herds like the land-based animals.
But the point you're making is that grazing animals are an incredibly important part of ecosystems, grassland and savanna ecosystems.
They are key and critical to maintaining healthy dynamics in those systems. So we can have, you know, grasslands that are then producing those types of, you know, animal products. We can have trees in those systems that are producing a whole multiple array of products, both, you know, foods, timber, you know, firewoods, but also habitat, for wild animals. So, and as we've kind of been talking about, it's human habitat. After all, it's really our own habits, in essence, that are responsible for creating habitat. And this has always been the case with humans.
When you start, like when somebody hires you, let's say, or when you are teaching how to design a farm, where do you start?
That's a great question. Well, I mean, kind of the simplest way that I put that is that we start with the heart. Starting with the heart is mainly about taking responsibility, I suppose. Not so much taking responsibility, but finding out or giving attention to what it is that you love, what it is that you care about, what it is you're passionate about, because those are the things that you will take responsibility for, and gladly so, because they're things that you want to see flourish in life. So it's important to have an understanding of, as the farmer or the person that's managing the land, stewarding that piece, of what those things are for themselves. What do they value? What kind of quality of life is required? Because depending on those pieces, the design might unfold quite differently. Because different people will have a different quality of life concern, say, around how much work they want to do, maybe with animals, or how much work they want to do with trees, or even at all. So figuring out those different factors is and the vision that leads to is really the most important place to start.
Let's say that you are here in northern New Mexico and somebody's got a piece of land and they say, I want to have a successful fruits and vegetables farm, maybe with some chickens on it or whatever, so that I can support myself and my family, which is not easy to do farming.
Sure.
Where do you go from there?
Well, I mean, that's a good outline of kind of some objectives. But usually we would even take, at least the way that I work, where I use often for that part of the process, holistic management. So this is one of the frameworks that I work with and that we talk about a lot at Kivira conferences and so on. Possibly some of your listeners have heard of this one.
What? Tell us what that means.
Holistic management was developed by Alan Savory. Most people know it because they have really good sort of grazing planning practices that can be implemented using holistic management. But actually, it's a far broader sort of approach. And at the core, it's about making consistently better decisions that are, you know, ecologically sound, financially sound, and socially sound. You know, if you don't have all three of those pieces kind of functioning, well, you're going to fall down somewhere along the way. And it won't be sustainable, it won't be regenerative, it won't be resilient. So part of the way we start to make good decisions is by defining what we call a holistic goal or a holistic context. We use both of those terms. It's basically a vision, you know, based on people's quality of life, on that idea of starting with the heart. What is this group of people who's managing this particular whole? What is the quality of life they want? And what has to be produced to give them that quality of life? Once we kind of can dial that in, we can be much more effective at designing something that can have a far better chance of accomplishing that into our rapidly changing future.
What are some of the biggest mistakes you see people make, like small farmers?
Well, I think one of the biggest mistakes is kind of not having that sort of big picture vision in place. So that, because what often happens there is we've not defined real clearly what it is that we're managing. So Stephen Covey has this idea of circle of influence versus circle of concern. So if we can identify the things that we really have pretty direct influence over in the systems that we're managing, we can focus and prioritize kind of our expenses and both time and money and energy on something that's really going to have a chance of getting us somewhere, as opposed to focusing time, money, or energy on things that are just in our circle of concern. Well, we're concerned about them, but really we can't really influence them that much.
Like what?
Well, like voting, I could say, to be a little provocative. In a national election, for example, most people don't really feel, that I talk to, and you can tell me if it's different, but don't really feel truly represented by kind of the national politics we have today. And their only kind of input into that is to vote. And so that's not really something in their circle of influence, direct influence. That's circle of concern. So maybe a better example, just to take it back to the land, would be rainfall. So with rainfall, there are aspects of rainfall that are not in our circle of influence, like, you know, exactly how much rainfall falls in our area.
You cannot make it rain.
We can't really influence that, at least, you know, not too much. But what we can influence very directly on our land is how much of that same rainfall actually infiltrates into our soils and doesn't run off, doesn't sort of, you know, create erosion and doesn't make all the water quality problems downstream and flooding and so on. Right. So we can directly influence how much of that water infiltrates just by having more soil cover and these kinds of things, good land management practices. So that would be in our circle of influence, as opposed to the rainfall itself might just would not be. It would be circle of concern.
Do you feel that all landscapes that are agricultural landscapes should have both animals and crops on them?
Well, I mean, I think that has to be up to each individual sort of, you know, land steward as far as what is their vision, what is their holistic context, what can they deal with. But I think in many, many landscapes, especially, you know, the drier you get, you will need to have animals, and I assume when you're saying that you're talking about larger livestock and all that. Obviously, there's always going to be
sheep, pigs,
soil,
cows, chickens.
Stuff,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm not talking about worms.
So hopefully you've got some worms wherever you are, but in the soil, you know, food web, soil biology working for you. But yes, as far as those larger animals, the drier you get, kind of the more critical those become to kind of driving, positive ecological health.
You started out a little while ago talking about the era that we're living in being an era of tremendous transformation socially, economically, in terms of land, I mean, population. What is your response to the kind of transformations we're going through? I mean, a lot of people are just thinking, we are on the edge of the apocalypse. You know, this is, it is not good. It is scary. I'm either going to go into denial or sit in fear, you know. But there's a whole set of people who are really looking at it differently, and I have a feeling you're one of them.
I like to think so, at least. It's absolutely, we are living at a moment in time that is entirely unprecedented. And, you know, we've been talking about this human lineage and going back millions of years and everything, and we've never been in a moment like this. But it's a moment of incredible transformation that is underway. It's a moment of where change is accelerating at rates we've never seen before in our entire history. It's a moment in which some would say we are inhabiting the monstrous. as one philosopher, I think, put it, inhabiting the monstrous. But I don't see this as being a downside. I see this as being an enormous opportunity for humans, an enormous opportunity to reconnect to the dynamics of our planet. We understand today, even in the last 10, 15 years, far more about Earth system dynamics, for example, than we ever have before. So we are really the first generation to actually kind of understand kind of what our activities have led to. So in essence, this age of the Anthropocene, which is it's now being called. We've moved out of the Holocene epoch and into the Anthropocene, which is a story about, you know, the fact that human impacts are at such a level that they will be geologically detectable, you know, 40 million years from now in the sediment layers, or they are on par with other forms of Earth system dynamics. But to me, that's also an incredible story of opportunity, because the fact that we have this much impact is not necessarily the problem. The issue is, what direction is that impact going? If we take that same amount of impact and turn it positively, which we are capable of doing, I believe, which we know how to do in many cases, I believe, basically by partnering with ecosystem processes, partnering with Earth system dynamics rather than trying to work against them, as we have been in the sort of last century's transformation, fossil fuel transformation, by turning our attention towards these things, reconnecting to the ecosphere, and using our powers for good, in essence, I think we'll have a very positive transformation this century.
What does that specifically look like, working with Earth's processes? Like, you know, like, take it down to Earth in the kind of work that you do every day.
Yeah, absolutely. It's taking those understandings of Earth system dynamics, and like I say, we're the first generation to even understand, really, what those are and how our impacts are falling out. We're also the last generation, arguably, to be able to do something about it, you know, in time. So there's an urgency behind some of this, but this is also an opportunity. So to take us out of maybe the monstrous and into the sublime. How do we do that? One paper that came out in 2009, there's been an update in 2015. It's called Planetary Boundaries. And this is kind of looking at the Earth system level. There's 9 boundaries that if we stay within those, we know we're in a safe operating space. So these are things like climate change, biodiversity loss, nitrogen and phosphorus loading on you know, in the climate system, and so on. So we know we're across the boundary on a few of those, and we know they interact. But we also know that we can apply that understanding at a local level. So yes, there are system dynamics, but how do we apply it at a local level? Well, we do this by creating and designing and implementing farming practices and agriculture, because agriculture is the most powerful, the most important sector of all the sectors. There would be no other sectors of our economy without agriculture underpinning it. Agriculture, the way we're currently practicing it, is also the most damaging to those 9 planetary boundaries and affects about all 9 of them. So if we actually turn that around and positively affect all 9 of those through the way we practice agriculture, we'll be much further along towards this positive transformation I'm talking about. So ways to do that are, you know, certainly practicing an agriculture that increases biodiversity. We've been talking about this kind of savanna idea of multifunctional agriculture. This would be one of the most highly biodiverse agriculturals possible, because savannas are among the most highly biodiverse biomes on the planet. They support more mammal biomass, for example, than any other biome on Earth. So these are highly diverse systems. So implementing that would be, you know, that would bring us back from the brink of that boundary crossing event. Climate change, you know, another boundary that we've crossed here, that would be also addressed by savanna ecosystems.
How's that?
Well, trees sequester carbon, and that's what most of the international dialogue has been around. Oh, we need to plant more forests to kind of sequester carbon. And it's true, trees sequester carbon. But most of that carbon is actually above ground and then therefore susceptible to fire and so on.
Meaning in the body of the tree.
In the body of the tree. There's some underground, but the majority of it is above ground in trees. And therefore, like I say, susceptible to being gassed off very rapidly in a fire, and you lose it all. Grasslands, on the other hand, can transform far more carbon into underground storage than can forest systems.
Which is so counterintuitive. You think of, you know, you see big trees with big leaves and they're photosynthesizing, and you think, how can that be less effective than a grassland for sequestering huge amounts of carbon underground? But in fact, that's what the math tells us.
That is what the math tells us, and this is carbon that can be stored underground for 500, 1,000 years, so very long periods of sequestration for this carbon. And because these grass plants, these perennial plants, are sort of turning over a lot of their biomass every year, and most of that biomass is underground, so this is one of the key reasons that it can actually store more carbon than forests. Now, if we mix the two together in the savanna, the sweet spot that we've been talking about, well, those systems, savannas, can actually store more carbon than either grasslands or forests alone. And this is partly because just those dynamics are more diverse. So you have scattered trees, you have grasslands that are still pumping everything underground, and the light shade from those trees actually allows the grasses to be even more productive and stay vegetative longer and so on. It's better for the grass, better for the animals, it's better for people.
What is your vision for the transformation of industrial agriculture from this unhealthy, it's going to collapse, it's just a question of when kind of system that we have now, to a genuinely sustainable and regenerative and resilient system? Like, what would that transformation look like? That's just a little question.
Yes. Well, I think this is a transformation that's absolutely already underway. And so what it looks like is something that you're likely to be able to see wherever you live already. If you just start giving it the kind of attention, start looking for it, you will find it. So there are farms now that are, are being sort of implemented this way. Joel Salatin's is one of the more famous examples of this, and there's a fantastic movie coming out about him next year, Polyfaces.
And he was made famous in The Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan.
That's right. And Food, Inc., which also was nominated for an Oscar, which I believe Polyfaces has a very good chance of that too. Because that film is not only about him, but it's all about many, many people whose lives have been changed by their connection in various ways to this farm. So this is where we can see this transformation already occurring, is in those types of examples. And I'm sure anybody listening here will have examples in their local community that they can see. If you go down, to find that grass-finished burger or whatever it is, and where's that farm locally that's providing your local butcher with that, that's going to be a story of this transformation. So it begins with these small steps, with people out there like you who are sort of providing a platform for this information to get out there, people like the Kavira Coalition who are creating, rehabilitating landscapes all over the Southwest. Some of the work I do, of course, is working with many, farmers or NGOs or nonprofits, but groups that are managing land basically in this direction, in a way that's basically going to be creating soil, not degrading soil. And every single consumer, anybody who eats food, basically can be a part of that story just by determining where they spend that food dollar. Is that dollar going to create soil, or is that dollar going to lose topsoil?
Right. And that is the basis of all food systems, plant and animal, is that topsoil.
Absolutely. Absolutely right. And so if we're losing 10 or 20 tons for every half ton of food as presently is happening, obviously something needs to change. And that something is changing. So kind of the next step for this transformation, I think, is just many of these individuals and groups who are doing this are, increasingly talking together, organizing together, so different levels are coming into this transformation that are setting it up, I believe, for a very rapid sort of onset phase coming in the relatively near future.
Owen Habletel is an educator and consultant in agroecosystem design. His company is called Whole Systems Transformations. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.